Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, Santa Cruz, KBDH, San Ardo. Streaming live and podcasting at KUSP.org. I'm Gary Shapiro, and it's time for From the Bookshelf. There have been approximately a zillion books written about Abraham Lincoln's life and death in the last seven score years or so. There have been a few just in the last 12 months, but Manhunt, the 12-day chase for Lincoln's killer, has captured the attention of America. It's a thrilling minute-by-minute account of the tragic crime that changed American history. It brings John Wilkes Booth out of history and into the present, allowing the reader to understand him, but not exactly sympathize with him. This delicate balancing act is accomplished with great skill by my guest tonight, James L. Swanson, the author of Manhunt. Mr. Swanson, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Oh, thanks. It's a pleasure to be on.
Now, you've written this riveting crime story. People don't usually think of the terms page-turner or I couldn't put it down when talking about 19th century history books, despite the fact that everybody knows how the story ends. How did you approach writing a book that everybody knows the ending to?
Well, in a couple ways, and you're right, it's a dilemma, because it's almost as though you're writing a book about the Titanic. How do you make it exciting? Because everybody knows the ship sank, and most of the people died. I did it in two ways. First, I decided to tell the story in real time, just as it happened. So I take you on Booth's 12-day ride after he killed the president, and I really try to put the reader in the saddle next to Booth, so that the reader of my book would see everything Booth saw, meet everyone he met, and experience everything he did, day by day, hour by hour, and in some cases, minute by minute. So I wanted it to feel like a novel or like a thriller, even though it's true. And then secondly, I went to the original sources, thousands of pages of letters, trial transcripts, diaries, books, documents, and I tried to tell the story as best as I could through the words of the people who participated in it, so that anything in the book, within quotation marks, as I mentioned at the beginning in a note to the reader, everything you read within quotation marks actually comes from an original source, either an affidavit from a participant, the trial transcripts, newspaper stories. So I think that use of original sources contributes a very vivid sense to the book. So I think it was those two things that helped me tell the story in an exciting way, by telling it in real time and using as many original sources as I could.
And there are quite a few quotations. How did you go about your research? How long did you spend working on Manhunt?
Well, all told, I spent 3 years on the book, but I also spent most of my life on the book. I was born on Lincoln's birthday, and when I was a boy, I was given Lincoln books and souvenirs from the Lincoln sites as a child, and I became interested in the assassination when I was about 10 years old, and that's when my grandmother, who was a veteran of the old Chicago tabloid newspaper scene, gave me a framed engraving of Booth's Derringer pistol, along with a part of a clipping from the Chicago Tribune from the morning of April 15th, 1865, the morning that Lincoln died. And I remember just being riveted by that original newspaper story. And I remember then reading it over and over again and saying to myself, I want to learn more about this. So in a way, I've been preparing to write this book for most of my life, but the hard work really took about 3 years.
And there's so many quotations. How did you were mentioning all of the things that you looked through. Where did you find all these things?
Well, a couple examples. The incredible diary that John Wilkes Booth kept during his escape. It wasn't really a diary. It was a date book, but he used it as a quasi-diary while he was on the run. And in this incredible document, which is probably one of the most exciting documents I use in the book, Booth describes why he killed Lincoln. He describes his mood of despair when he realizes that the North and the South has condemned him for what he's done. He writes a plea to God to spare him the death of a common criminal. So some of these things come right out of Booth's mouth as he wrote them in his diary. I also read all the known letters and memorandums and documents written by Booth, and I read a large percentage of Abraham Lincoln's collected works, over 10 volumes. I read affidavits taken days after the events by people who had seen Booth or helped him, even affidavits from one of Booth's co-conspirators who traveled with him on the 12-day hunt, and he revealed things about Booth and what Booth said that no one else knew. And War Department telegrams ordering troops to pursue Booth. Memoirs written by members of Lincoln's cabinet with their first-hand recollections of Lincoln and then later their first-hand recollections of the assassination. One of the best sources was a wonderful diary kept by Fanny Seward, the young daughter of Secretary of State Seward, who was almost stabbed to death by one of Booth's conspirators while the actor was killing Lincoln. And she wrote an incredible memoir of how one of Booth's conspirators, Lewis Powell, invaded their home, stabbed her brothers, stabbed a U.S. Army male nurse guarding Seward, almost stabbed her, and it's an unparalleled dramatic account of what happened that night in the Seward mansion when the Secretary of State was almost stabbed to death. So those are just a few examples of the rich variety of sources that existed for me to tap into to tell the story.
I want to know more about Seward and about Booth, but first I want to ask you another thing. Your narrative, as you were saying, you know, it stays in the moment, with the one exception of the scene where Laura Keene comes to the dying president's box at Ford's Theater. That's such a bizarre little chapter in your story. Can you tell us a little bit about Laura Keene?
Yes, Laura Keene was the star of the play Our American Cousin, which Lincoln saw that night at Ford's Theater on Good Friday evening. She was a celebrated actress and a well-known impresario who not only acted, but commissioned plays, purchased plays, staged productions, managed a theater. And this was her 1,000th performance in the play. And she was in the wings when John Wilkes Booth crept into the president's box and fired that fatal shot. Then when the audience broke out in pandemonium, she took to center stage and she told everyone to be calm, all will yet be well. But then she looked up at that box, and she must have realized that history was being made in that theater box and that she wanted to be part of it. So she took a hidden staircase to the second floor. She made her way to the box, and she stepped inside. Lincoln was on the floor. The doctors were examining him. Mary Lincoln was in the booth, and so were the Lincoln's theater companions, including Major Henry Rathbone, who had been stabbed badly by Booth. And she met an incredible request of Dr. Leal, the first physician who came to Lincoln. She asked if she could drop to her knees and cradle the dying president's head in her lap. Lincoln had been shot through the brain, and so blood and brain matter was oozing from the wound. And he said, yes, fine. And she held Lincoln's head in her lap, and her dress became stained with his blood and brains. And that dress became the object of public fascination. People asked her to model, wear the dress and model it for him. When she wasn't looking, people tried to cut swatches from it. And ultimately, she banned it from her sight, and she gave it to her daughter and son-in-law. And the dress is long gone, but five fragments remain, each stained with Lincoln's blood. In other books on the assassination, she's presented in very heroic terms. And I questioned that. What she did was of no medical benefit or no psychological benefit to Lincoln. He'd been unconscious from the moment he was shot. And I became convinced, based on my research, that she did this not to help Lincoln, but to ensure her own immortality. She staged this impromptu scene because she knew that if she did this, she would be remembered forever, just as we do remember her forever.
Right. Here we are talking about her. Here we are talking about her.
Yes, and one Civil War journalist, one of the greatest, George Alfred Townsend, who I rely on very much in my book, caught on to what she was doing, because in one of his reports on the assassination, he said, and so, there lay the sacred leader of 30 millions of people laying in the pent-up closet of a playhouse, dabbling with his sacred blood, the robes of an actress. But in the 140 years since the assassination, no one had really offered this alternative explanation of her motives and why she did this. And I felt strongly about it, so I did want to include this in the book.
It's a great little sequence. And now let me ask you to take it a little bit further than you do in the book. So whatever happened to Laura Keene? Did she ever play in Our American Cousin again?
No, I don't believe she did. The play was dropped from the popular repertoire for some time. She lived on and enjoyed great success in the theater, but as far as I know, she didn't play in that play again.
We're chatting tonight with James L. Swanson. He's the author of Manhunt, The 12-Day Chase for Lincoln's Killer. Another bizarre footnote in your story, and you don't even mention it until you're afterward, but the fate of Rathbone and his companion, the Lincoln's guests in the theater that night.
Oh, yes. Major Henry Rathbone, a U.S. Army major, and his fiancée, Clara Harris, the daughter of a U.S. senator. And he was stabbed by Booth, and he survived that night, and he did marry his fiancée. But then 18 years later, when they were living in Germany, around Christmas time, he began acting very oddly and behaved in a manner threatening to their children. And then, in a bizarre recreation of what happened at Ford's Theater, Rathbone chose the very weapons Booth had used that night, a pistol and a knife, and he shot and stabbed to death his wife. And I say in the book that in retrospect, it's unfortunate for Clara Harris that John Wilkes Booth did not serve her better the night he killed Lincoln. And she would have been far better off if Booth had stabbed Rathbone one more time and slain him on that Good Friday night in 1865, which would certainly have saved her from being murdered by her husband 18 years later.
Was he imprisoned? Or?
Yes, he was sent to a German insane asylum, and he spent the rest of his life there. He never came back to America.
That is really weird.
Yes, it is. It is one of the strangest sidebars of the story.
Before we get to Booth, let me ask you about another one. One of the, I guess, the lasting controversies of the Lincoln assassination is the guilt or innocence of Dr. Mudd, the doctor who set Booth's broken leg. Booth broke his leg after he leapt to the stage after murdering the president. So, what's your take on the Mudd story? Is he a guilty conspirator or innocent victim?
Dr. Mudd was lucky that he was not hanged with four of Booth's other conspirators who were executed on July 7th, 1865, a few months after the assassination. The story of Dr. Mudd was always that he was an innocent country physician following his Hippocratic oath, treating the broken leg of a stranger. It was all a lie. John Wilkes Booth and Dr. Samuel A. Mudd knew each other. When Booth was plotting to kidnap Abraham Lincoln several months before the assassination, he spent the evening with Dr. Mudd and actually slept at his house. Dr. Mudd helped him buy a horse to use in the kidnapping plot. He took him to the stables where the horse was shod. They met at a local church. They met in Washington, D.C., and retired to the privacy of a hotel room for conversation. Confederate agents in Montreal had given Booth's name to Mudd. Mudd was cruel to his slaves. He was anti-Union, anti-Lincoln, and he was known as a Confederate sympathizer and operative. I am absolutely convinced that when John Wilkes Booth arrived at Dr. Mudd's farm at 4 a.m. in the morning on April 15, 1865, Mudd knew exactly who his caller was. And in fact, after Mudd was sentenced to life in prison, but then pardoned just 4 years later, he confessed to a fellow Confederate that he knew it was Booth all along. And Dr. Mudd's own lawyer later said that Dr. Mudd was a liar. He lied about everything. And not only did Mudd know who Booth was, he concealed that from the authorities for days to help Booth escape. And when he finally said something, he said it was a stranger, he didn't know who he was, he couldn't help them. He knew always that it was Booth, and once he knew that Booth assassinated the president, he helped keep secret the fact that Booth had been at his home, and he gave Booth a head start of 2 or 3 days to try to escape from the manhunters. Dr. Mudd, if he knew about the plot to kidnap Abraham Lincoln, and I believe he did, should have been executed.
You're saying he didn't know, of course, that I guess he would have no way of knowing that Booth had killed the president.
No, I don't believe he knew about the assassination in advance. Booth acted on short notice. There would have been no time to notify Mudd, even if he had wanted to. I do believe that when Booth arrived at Dr. Mudd's house at 4 a.m. that morning, Mudd didn't yet know that Lincoln had been shot or that Booth had been the assassin. But during that visit, Mudd did learn that it was Booth who had shot Lincoln. And yet, even knowing that, he withheld from the authorities Booth's presence at his home to give Booth a head start.
Then why do you think, you know, even 100 and some years later, the Mudd family persisted in trying to get their ancestor cleared of his charge?
Well, they've done an incredible job of dealing with the media, of telling the story, their version of the story. In 1936, there was a movie, Prisoner of Shark Island, that portrayed Mudd as the innocent man. More recently, there was one starring Dennis Weaver that suggested Mudd was innocent. It's a story that appeals to people. It's more dramatic to think he was an innocent man wrongly convicted. But that's not really the case at all.
And yet there was a hanged conspirator who was virtually innocent of any wrongdoing, wouldn't you say?
Well, of the four who were executed, one of them, Lewis Powell, the ex-Confederate soldier, nearly stabbed to death Secretary of State Seward in his bed, and he knew about the plot to kill Lincoln. The other one, George Atzerodt, a German immigrant, was assigned by Booth to murder Vice President Johnson. Now, he didn't make the attempt. He got drunk and he ran away. But he knew that Lincoln was marked for death that night. He was part of the conspiracy. He didn't go to the authorities and say, Booth is going to try to kill Lincoln tonight. So he was certainly part of that murder conspiracy. Then there was David Harold, a young druggist clerk from Washington, who guided Lewis Powell to Secretary of State Seward's home to accomplish the murder. And then he rendezvoused with Booth that night and spent the next 12 days of the manhunt with Booth, helping him be on the run. The final person executed was Mary Surratt, a 42-year-old widow who owned a boarding house in Washington and a country tavern 13 miles south of the city.
And did she really, would you say that she deserved to be hanged?
Certainly she deserved to be imprisoned and possibly hanged if the following is true. Her son was an important Confederate agent and operative who was deeply involved in Booth's conspiracy to kidnap the president. He introduced Booth to many of his fellow co-conspirators. The day of these, and many of the conspirators would meet with Booth at Mary Surratt's boarding house. She certainly knew her son was a Confederate agent. I believe she knew her son was involved in the plot to kidnap Abraham Lincoln. On the afternoon of the assassination, Booth stopped alone at her tavern and met with her privately. Immediately after that, she got in a carriage and drove a package that he had given her to her country tavern in Maryland. It was Booth's binoculars. Then she told the innkeeper there, "Get the shooting irons ready. Parties will call for them tonight." Booth and his conspirators had stashed weapons there, two Spencer carbines, repeating rifles, along with some other supplies. And then when Lewis Powell, the man who nearly killed Secretary of State Seward, was on the run and he showed up at her door two nights later when soldiers were questioning her, she denied recognizing him and she said she'd never seen him before in her life, even though he had been in her home. So it was those pieces of evidence, those pieces of circumstantial evidence, that led to her conviction. If she knew about the plot to kidnap Lincoln, she certainly should have been punished. I mean, the idea of conspiring to kidnap the President of the United States during a momentous civil war, you're guilty of something very serious.
It's fair to say she was an accomplice to the crime then.
I think so.
We're talking to James L. Swanson. He's the author of a fabulous book about John Wilkes Booth and the assassination of President Lincoln called Manhunt. Now, let's talk a little bit about, I don't want to call him the hero of your book, but I guess in a way he is, and that's John Wilkes Booth. How famous was John Wilkes Booth in his day? Can you compare him to somebody today that will give us a good idea of how famous he was?
I think so. I think he could certainly be compared to a Russell Crowe, a Brad Pitt, a Matt Damon, not George Clooney, someone like that. He was certainly one of the top three or four male stars of his time.
As famous as his brother, Edwin?
Yes, for different reasons. Edwin was known as the perhaps the purer, more emotional actor with a range of deep emotion. John Wilkes Booth was more widely renowned for his passion, for his incredible athletic abilities, his leaping abilities. At one time he was even nicknamed the gymnastic actor because of his amazing ability to leap and bound across the stage and engage in sword fighting and knife fighting. It was a different kind of fame. He was certainly renowned for his attractiveness. Women and men would stop in the street to admire him as he passed. He was beautifully dressed. He was 26 years old, wealthy, celebrated by many, and known throughout all the major cities of the North and the South. He was certainly a star of his time.
Is it true that President Lincoln had seen Booth perform Shakespeare at some point?
We think he had seen Booth perform. Lincoln was a big fan of the theater. He went to many plays at Ford's Theater and at Grover's Theater. Lincoln read Shakespeare. He liked reading it aloud to his friends. The thinking is that Lincoln almost certainly did see John Wilkes Booth perform.
Now, why didn't Booth, if the Confederacy, the cause of the Confederacy was so dear to him, why didn't he become a Confederate soldier?
Well, he said this in documents that he wrote in his own hand, that if he joined the Confederate Army, he would be just one man carrying a rifle. And if he died, he would be dead, and that would be the end of his contribution. He argued that with his acting skills, his connections, his ability to travel in North and South, he was worth 20 men or more because of his wealth, his ability to scheme, to launch secret plans. So he felt it would be a waste of his talent and his skills and his connections to just pick up a rifle and join the ranks. He thought he would be much more effective working underground on behalf of the Confederacy.
Well, other than the one night that he acted on his plans, did he ever do any of those things?
Well, yes, he did. He did organize a conspiracy to kidnap Abraham Lincoln in the fall of 1864 and early 1865. And they actually took to the roads on a particular day to intercept Lincoln's carriage at the outskirts of Washington and seize him at gunpoint. But Lincoln changed his plans at the last minute and didn't show up that day. So Booth did take prior action before he committed the assassination, but the plan just didn't work out.
Now, speaking of guns, if you were Booth, would you have used the gun that he used?
No. Booth entered a theater of 1,500 people, entered Lincoln's box with four people occupying it, and all he was armed with was a single-shot, muzzle-loading, percussion cap, .44 caliber Derringer pistol. He only had one round to fire. It was a muzzle-loading weapon. It would have taken 20 to 40 seconds to reload it. And that's when he's alone, without action around him, without Major Rathbone trying to interfere with him. So it was clear. Booth could only fire one shot. His only other weapon in his possession in the box was a knife, which he used to stab Rathbone. If Booth had missed, which he almost did, Rathbone and Lincoln could have overpowered him, and Lincoln would have survived the night. I don't know why Booth did that. Were I Booth, I would have carried a six-shot Colt or Remington Army revolver or Navy revolver. If you miss once, you have five more shots. I don't know if Booth did it to heighten the sense of drama, to heighten the risk to himself, almost like a hunter boasting that he would take his prey with one shot. I don't know why Booth used that weapon, but unfortunately, Booth was a good enough shot that he did strike Lincoln with his first and only shot and shot him behind the left ear, and the bullet went completely through Lincoln's brain.
Had he used a different weapon, couldn't he have killed the president and slipped out of the box without ever being seen? Yet he made sure that he was seen, right?
Yes, he wanted to be seen. The only way out of the box was to jump to the stage, because he had barred the door leading into the box behind him, because he knew there was no way he could make it across the back wall, down the staircase, and out the front door without the patrons stopping him. The clearest method of escape would be to jump to the stage when there'd only be one actor on stage when he fired a shot. He timed the attack for that moment. And so he dropped to the stage, ran past a few actors in the wings, and ran out the back door where he had stationed his horse. It was being held for him by someone. And so he was able to bypass the entire audience and get out the back of the theater, and only one man got up to pursue him. And, of course, it not only helped Booth's escape. He didn't kill Lincoln. He performed the assassination. He didn't shave his mustache. He didn't wear a mask. He didn't wear a disguise. He jumped to that stage, and then he took center stage, paused, faced the audience, and cried out, "Sic Semper Tyrannis," which is the state motto of Virginia, thus always to tyrants. And then he cried out, "The South is avenged." And just before he left the stage, he exulted to himself, "I have done it." What he was telling the audience was, "It's me, look at me. I, John Wilkes Booth, have just slain the president. He wanted to be recognized. He had conflicting motives. He wanted to escape. It wasn't a suicide mission. He wanted to escape to the Deep South and enjoy the fame and immortality that he thought should be his. But he also wanted the renown for it. So these two motives were in conflict. He wanted to escape, and yet he wanted to be seen.
Now, given the intricacy of his plans, you would think that he must have had months to prepare for this assassination. But according to your story, only a few hours.
Yes, yes. He was partly prepared because of his earlier preparations to kidnap Lincoln. So he already had conspirators. He had already armed them with weapons. He knew the names of certain Confederate agents leading out of Washington through Maryland and into Virginia. And so he knew approximately what his escape route would be. He had already put the Spencer carbines in Mary Surratt's Country Tavern south of Washington. And that was to be his first stop after he killed Lincoln and fled the city. So in part, his route was ready. He had conspirators. But he really didn't decide to kill Lincoln until around noon on Good Friday, April 14th, when he went to Ford's Theater to pick up his mail, and he was sitting on the front step. And as he read his letter aloud and laughed, someone, we don't know who, told him Lincoln was coming that night. And that really set off the ticking clock in Booth's mind as it wound down. And he knew that he had just about 8 hours left to make his preparations, and there was just enough time to get his horses ready, round up his conspirators, have a final meeting with them at a hotel a few blocks from Ford's Theater, and then assign them their tasks of murdering Johnson and Seward, and he said he would kill Lincoln alone. And so Booth had just enough time to do all these things.
And have a few drinks.
Yes, his last drink at the Star Saloon next door to Ford's Theater. He went straight from the bar, walked into the theater, and walked up to the box and shot Lincoln.
Now, why do you think Booth is so mythologized? You contrast his image with that of Lee Harvey Oswald, imagining if people were to wear Lee Harvey Oswald T-shirts, people would think that was in pretty bad taste.
Yeah, well, I think in a few ways, Booth has somehow been forgiven for his crime, or at least been made into some sort of antiquarian hero, folk hero. And I'll give you a couple examples. In the streets surrounding Ford's Theater during tourist season, and over a million people visit Ford's Theater in Washington every year, there are street banners with large photos of Booth on them. Now, imagine if you'd go to Dallas, Texas. Would you expect to find street banners with the photo of Lee Harvey Oswald? Or let's say you'd go to Memphis, where Martin Luther King was assassinated. Would you find street banners with the photo of James Earl Ray on them? I don't think so. And in other ways, too, if you go to the new Abraham Lincoln Museum in Springfield, Illinois, there's a life-size wax figure of John Wilkes Booth near the Lincoln family, near Frederick Douglass, near General Grant. You'd never go to the John F. Kennedy Library and find a wax figure of Lee Harvey Oswald. That would be obscene.
In fact, Oswald is not even mentioned in that library.
That's right. And so I think one reason this has happened, it's partly the passage of time, but also part of the credit, if you can call it that, belongs to Booth. Unlike our other assassins, who were ciphermen and non-entities before they struck and became remembered, you know, who was Oswald? Who was James Earl Ray? They were non-entities. Booth was our only assassin who was first famous before he committed his crime. And second, he was the only actor. And Booth played this role so well. He just didn't kill Lincoln. He performed the assassination. He performed through his escape. He performed brilliantly an impromptu performance at the Garrett Barn on the 12th day of the manhunt when soldiers surrounded it and demanded that he come out and set the barn on fire. And he engaged them in incredible dialogue and drama. He was really staging his last performance for the American people because he knew the soldiers would write of what they had seen and all of America would hear about it. So I think Booth did such an effective, dramatic job of performing this entire sequence of events. He somehow tricked us and tricked our minds into believing it all isn't quite real. It's just a play. This is something that Shakespeare could have written or any other great dramatist. And so Booth has partly created the illusion through his performance that it didn't really happen. It's just a play. It's just a drama. And we forget that Booth was a racist, a murderer, that he killed our greatest president. And somehow we view it through the prism of theatrical conventions. I think those are some of the reasons why.
Well, one thing that Manhunt does is erase the passage of time between the event and today. It seems like I'm reading an account as it happens.
And certainly what I try to do at the end of the book is make the reader realize that Booth is not the hero of my story. And certainly he's not my hero. The hero of my book is Abraham Lincoln. And so that I hope that even though Lincoln leaves the story after the first third of the book, that people still feel the ongoing presence of Lincoln haunting the story. I tried very hard to not let Lincoln leave the book because I really wanted his memory and his legacy to linger throughout the book so that everyone would realize at the end, even though you've spent this incredible 12-day chase with John Wilkes Booth, he's not the hero. Abraham Lincoln is.
The loss of Lincoln was great to this country. What do you think? How do you think the world would be different if Lincoln had lived?
I don't know. It's so hard to say. Perhaps the death of Lincoln made it easier for the Republicans to pass the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments to help the freed slaves. But I think if Lincoln had been president during Reconstruction, it would have been better for the millions of freed slaves and for all of America. Lincoln, I think, it wouldn't have been easy. And Lincoln wouldn't have been the hero he was because the assassination made him into the martyr. But I think Lincoln's genius, his writing skills, his speaking skills, his heartfelt passion for all Americans, for the defeated Southerners, for the freed slaves, would have somehow helped him, as he said in his second inaugural, bind up the nation's wounds. There is also the Churchill scenario. I'm convinced that Winston Churchill was one of the greatest people of the 20th century. And I also believe that if it were not for Winston Churchill, Great Britain would have been invaded by Nazi Germany. And yet, how do the British people thank Churchill in 1945 after they won? After he won, they threw him out. Now, you couldn't have thrown out Lincoln because he was just entering a second term and he would have been president for the next 4 years. But Lincoln would have had a tough time, but I think somehow he would have survived and he would have made America better in the post-war time.
Oh, in other words, in the same way that Woodrow Wilson was rejected by the American people, that could have happened too.
It could very possibly have happened.
Now, tell us about the Manhunt movie. When is that coming?
Well, the Manhunt movie is being made by Walden Media, which produced the Chronicles of Narnia film, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and also other films. And they're hoping to start filming this fall. And they haven't cast a John Wilkes Booth yet, so I'm most curious to see who that will be.
Well, it would have to be a handsome individual. I'm available. You can.
I think it's going to have to be with someone with Booth-like qualities. If you have a mesmerizing quality that almost hypnotizes women, makes men admire you. If you have deep black eyes, pale skin, and a charismatic look. It's time to audition
me
for that role.
most nonfiction books, they have a pretty limited run, but how many copies of Manhunt are in print?
Well, there are. It's in its eighth printing, and there are about 250,000 books in print.
That's pretty amazing.
I'm lucky that it's been on the New York Times bestseller list for 3 months.
Luck had nothing to do with it. It's a fantastic, fantastic book.
Oh, thank you.
How will you follow it up? What's going to be your next project?
Well, I'm doing a related book. I'm doing a book on what I call the final journeys of the two presidents. I don't have a title for it yet, but what it's about is first Lincoln's final journey, the magnificent funeral train that transported his body to the great cities of the North, and it stopped in the major cities for open coffin funerals. Millions of people witnessed the procession of the Lincoln funeral train through the country. And this, of course, was Lincoln's journey home to Springfield and to American secular sainthood. But while this was going on, there was another journey happening, the manhunt for Jefferson Davis, president of the Confederacy. He was on the run for his life, and he was also trying to save his country. He was upset that Lee had surrendered. He wanted him to fight a guerrilla war. He hoped to keep alive Confederate armies in Texas, the Trans-Mississippi, and North Carolina. He didn't want to give up. And so while the hunt for Booth is taking place, what's also happening is this magnificent funeral journey home of Abraham Lincoln and this thrilling escape and chase of Jefferson Davis, the president of the dying Confederacy. So my story is about these two journeys and how they relate and intersect each other.
Well, now I'm thinking of a thousand things I want to ask you about Jefferson Davis, but we'll have to save that for when your next book comes out, and I hope you will come back and join us again.
No, I would love to. Thank you.
My guest tonight has been James L. Swanson. His book, Manhunt, The 12-Day Chase for Lincoln's Killer, is one of the great nonfiction books in history. Thank you for spending some time with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to From the Bookshelf this week. I'll be back again next week with another great program. I hope you'll join me Sunday nights at 9, right after the Poetry Show here on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. Our From the Bookshelf staff is Miss Breanne Beal. Thanks, Breanne. Stick around for Jazz with Michael Lambert. From the Bookshelf was created by Billy Harris. I'm Gary Shapiro for KUSP. Good night, everybody.